All right. Welcome everyone to the IPv6 track. First of all, some reminders is that all of these sessions are being recorded, so if you have any questions, please wait for a microphone so we can get it recorded too. Before I start, a few other remarks. My name is Curtis Lindquist, and I'm gonna be the moderator of this session, and I'll also fill part of the gap that was left by Jeff Houston, who couldn't make it. So I'll give a presentation about some statistics of IPv6 usage in Sweden. Before that, we also had Detlef Eckert from the European Commission, who will, I think, talk a bit about the Commission's view on IPv6. I was also asked to remind you all that there is currently, today and tomorrow, there are firewall testing of compatibility testing of IPv6 being done in Exhibition Hall B downstairs. They'd really like you to stop by, visit, say hi, give them input and feedback, and see how the tests are going if you're interested. Before we start, though, I just wanted to make a short little survey. How many of you are familiar with IPv6 at all? Well, that's quite a few of you. How many of you actually run IPv6? Now I'm actually shocked here. All right. How many of you actually are dependent on IPv6? Two. Oh, no, three. Okay. All right. Well, listen, not so bad then. We'll see what the presenters can give you if you learn something today. Because I have quite a full agenda, I'll let Detlef start, and we'll go to the Commission view.
Okay. Thank you. Actually, I will do a real follow-up of the presentation of Patrick this morning. Unfortunately, I couldn't really 100% follow the speech of your minister, but I guess she didn't say that the Swedish government is enabling the Swedish website on IP version 6, did she? She did. She did not. That would be because I couldn't get this, because this is the first step that we all in the public sector should be doing. To be frank, today, you go to the European Commission website, and you won't find an IP version 6 website. This always puts me in a very embarrassing situation, talk about IP version 6, but not having it enabled. I have lengthy discussion with our IT department on how to do it, when to do it, and so on and so forth. They're studying it, that we have a team already, and I could even provide some budget. Every time there's a new problem. There's a new problem with some servers, there's a problem with connections and a new task and new priorities. IP version 6 always been brought backwards and backwards, and maybe this even sounds familiar to your own situation. The question is, now, as Commission, we should do what we preach. In industry, it's called eat your own dog food. There's also the question of what is the policy dimension to IP version 6 at European level. The discussion or the presentation of Patrick and coming from Jeff Houston set the scene already. It's the address problem, and he has been analyzing this for years now. There are two options, and I think today you heard a number of variations of those options, plan A, plan B, IPX, and what have you. Actually, the real problem is we can go on as we do, and that at one point in time, when the pain is big enough, we gradually switch to IP version 6, or we find something else. That you have listened to him, and you saw the implications of that strategy. The other one is that we really say we do it proactively, and we implement IP version 6. This is what ICANN, the RIRs, and many other internet community and constituencies are telling us and telling everyone, it's the better solution to move ahead. We have shared this view for now a couple of years, and we have now in May this year adopted another action plan, and I will briefly tell about what it is. The uptake of IP version 6 still is slow, and there are a number of reasons for it. In particular, the reason is that the individual interest or the individual benefit is not high enough. Only if we move collectively ahead, we can make a difference. How do you trigger this kind of collective move? Very often in the regulatory or in telecom, we could make this through regulation, universal service or access regulation and so on and so forth. In IP version 6 or an IP environment, this is not possible. So we only have to work with the market actors to find out. When public policy in a situation where you have a collective action problem can make a difference if we move ahead collectively. And this is something that we need to bring ahead. And therefore, our first step was to propose an objective, to say we should have made a significant move by 2010 in the European Union to use IP version 6, or at least to be IP version 6 ready. And we put a target to a 25%. That had the effect that those press articles were copied all over the world, and in China, in Japan, in the US, the ministries were presented with this. Europeans are moving 25%. We need to do the same. Well, that already was an achievement, but of course we need to follow up with some activities. And the number one problem that we need to solve is there is not enough content and services out of the internet on IP version 6. So today, when you go on IP version 6, there is not much available in native language to you, so you have to have some sort of gateways and translation services. We have heard this today. How can we move, how can we incentivize people to move to IP version 6 when what they have to fear is even negative, namely a service which is less good than on IP version 4, more latency, response time, and so on and so forth. So how can you do that? And the sad answer is you have not many arguments in hand. The only argument that you have is be prepared on time when your customers come on IP version 6 because of the address scarcity, then it is easier for you to offer the service. The second one may be reputation, innovator. Why not being one of those leaders and make even a kind of PR an image point out of it? And here maybe governments can help by acknowledging, let's say, newspapers or TV channels or search engines, whatever, when they move actually to IP version 6. Even the customer demand is relatively low. So it could be an image point. There could also be, for bigger companies, a kind of corporate social responsibility point of view, but that remains to be seen. So what we are currently only can be doing here is to talk to content providers, to service providers, make them aware and try to give them recognition. But it's a long way, and all governments in the European Union have to do the same. So we would hopefully get all 27 member states on the same track to talk to their content providers. The second thing is to stimulate outreach to the corporate network owners. In the enterprise sectors, the resistance to move to IP version 6 is particularly big. ISPs see a business continuity problem in the long run and are getting prepared, but on the medium-sized and even the bigger enterprise customers, the awareness is close to zero and the readiness is really low. Now, how do you get those people to move with the same argument, be timely prepared? And what we need to do here is to partner with multipliers, big companies like HP, IBM, Microsoft, Oracle, and also some of the telcos, so that they teach and preach to their customers that they need to be prepared for IP version 6. Probably the biggest, or the policy actions with the biggest impact we have is public procurement. This has been said very often, use public procurement. First of all, it's the showcase, we do the same. But also, if we enable IP version 6 and if we demand IP version 6 services from the ISPs, we can create a demand. Now, if the European Commission does it, it's nothing. If Swedish government does it alone, it's nothing. But if we do this together at European level, that's something. And if we coordinate maybe with the US and with the Japanese and so on and so forth, we may create a clear signal to the market. Already the OMB, the Office of Management Budget in the US, they had an instruction 2005 that all agencies should be ready by June 2008 for IP version 6, had an impact on several of the providers and manufacturers in the US. So we could do the same, and we can even move ahead more on the application side. So these are potential that we have, And we actually need to do this. Last but not least, we need to really watch and monitor the security and privacy implications, not because that IP version 6 is by default more secure than IP version 4, but rather it has some implications for security and privacy that needs to be monitored because it's different in some of the aspects of security. And this is what I would like to elaborate a little bit on two slides. And I don't want to spend too much time, but just give you the impression on what it means when you talk about IP version 6 security. Because in general, what you hear is that IP version 6 is more secure, and what they mean is because IPsec is in the stack, is in the protocol as extension, and whilst IPsec is portable to IP version 4. But that doesn't mean that IPsec is enabled for all IP version 6 applications. In fact, they are not. So one of the advantages when you look closer to IP version 6 is that the large address space makes the identification, the scanning of host identities and available ports more difficult. But there are ways around and there are new attack vectors. So in the end, what you're talking about is security by obscurity, which helps, but which is not a real big security advantage as such. IP version 6 security issues are unfortunately slightly different and sometimes significantly different from the IP version 4 security. So you have to understand the different notions and some different implementation rules. And I guess you might touch upon this in your tutorial. Because there's less experience in the market around, and people need to learn about this. One example I picked here is that you no longer have ARPs, but you have neighbor discovery and auto configuration, which has different implications for your network. There are a number of products already in the security sphere, security products like intrusion detection systems and firewalls, which do not have full support. There are some tests and some surveys around to see that, but certainly those products are still a little bit behind the established IP version 4 world. This shouldn't prevent you from deploying it, but it's simply a question of looking exactly at the product and demanding the features and the support for it. So it's something to watch out how this is going to develop. It's not a real obstacle because it will be solved over time, but if you today do this, you have a little less choice than for IP version 4. There are recently a number of protocol weaknesses exposed. A year ago, two French researchers found a number of attack vectors using type 0 routing header, and they came to the conclusion that this type 0 should be simply disabled and the best be even deprecated from the protocol. You need type 2 for mobile IP version 6, but this one, they concluded, it's only useful for attackers. So there are a number of things to be studied and to look at in the future. Then, although you may not have IP version 6 enabled on your network, you may still nevertheless run IP version 6 because it's tunneled, and you may have even some islands because in IP version 6 even a host can be used as a router. So there are a number of issues in the deployment. Even you do not actively have IP version 6 in your mind, if you haven't set your firewalls properly and so on and so forth, you may be confronted with some tunneling aspects. The opportunity with IP version 6, and we have been thinking about the applications that could drive IP version 6. Well, in the essence is, and you have heard this today, it's an infrastructure and the user don't care about so much IP version 4 and 6. And in the end, the user should not really see a difference. It should be transparent in one way or the other. As a network operator, you, of course, have a different view on this. But in the end, it is an infrastructure decision and should be treated as such. Nevertheless, there are some opportunities which could make the decision for CIOs and for network owners to move to IP version 6 more attractive. And one of them I've elaborated a little bit in the sense of end-to-end security. So what you have is the large address space coupled with the possibility for end-to-end using IPsec. And what it could mean is that you move your perimeter basically on your perimeter defense basically on the host. And you do a host-centric security model, which means you can be more agile with your customers and with your own employees by granting them access from wherever they are. And you can have a different security model which gets away with the false impression that once you have a good gateway protection that your network is secure, but rather to move the security more closer to the hosts. That could be something in the future whereby even there is a visible advantage to move to IPv6 in terms of applications. What are our current activities at EU level? And I would like to conclude with this kind of overview. The first thing is we have a discussion with the member states. I spoke about at the beginning of the necessity to have all 27 member states to move ahead. Now, because that is critical mass. We will have a so-called council in 27th of November, whereby we hope to get some clear messages and agreement, messages to the industry and agreement amongst member states about the way forward. So the idea would be to specify the requirements for public procurement and to set common targets when and how to move websites and services and so on and so forth on IPv6. That is my current and our current priority. It is pretty much work to get everyone on board. We are in the process of launching a study to measure the deployment of IPv6, which goes beyond what you currently have on the internet, where you can see all kinds of statistics in the routing tables and so on and so forth. So we will go a little bit deeper, and together with a consultant, we're going to deeply measure who is using IPv6 for which applications and so on and so forth. Then we currently have two Framework 7. This is our research program. We have two projects, 6Deploy and FIPSANS, which is a project for autonomic networks using IPv6. And 6Deploy is a deployment, as the name suggests, a deployment project, also helping third countries in Africa, for instance, to get to IPv6. And we have a number of outreach activities. Well, today this is one of those, but we also talk to some consultancy companies so that they can talk to their customers. But when you talk to some of the consultants companies, such as Gartner, you will feel the same kind of response, that they are saying, well, we tell our customers, get slowly ready, but don't invest yet. So this is also a kind of mindset that we need to change, that people get proactively ahead. Otherwise, we will stuck in option one and with all the consequences you have heard today. And last but not least, we need the international cooperation, because European Union is only a part of the internet. You have seen this from Vin Cerf's presentation, how many internet users you have in the different areas. So without Asia, without the United States, and Latin America, and at the end of the day, Africa, you cannot move anything on the internet. So we need the international cooperation to move ahead. But as European Union, we have a chance to take the lead, but we need people like here in Sweden to support us in this activity. That's my overview. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Detlef?
Yeah.
No questions? All right. Thank you very much.
We
had a gift earlier. Sorry. We had someone with a microphone, I thought, at the back.
Throw it over the fence.
My question is, the European Union TLD, is it IPv6 enabled?
You mean the .eu?
Yeah.
The .eu, yes. It means, what it means is you find quadruple A entries in the .eu domain, yes.
All right. And has possibly the European Union, the Commission, agreed with member states to enable all the member states CCTLDs?
This is not necessarily something we can agree with the member states, because the registries are not, let's say, dependent on the governments.
All right.
But of course, we can incentivize them.
Absolutely.
And so this is part of the 27th November.
I'm also thinking about a couple of new projects in the program. I think it's the seventh program. I'm thinking of the e-participation, which has a view to be really ubiquitous around the union. Will that has a demand? Will it have a demand in it to be?
For the time being, no.
All right.
For the time being, no. For the time being, we rely on the research program, if you like, and also a program which is called Competitiveness and Innovation. But those are programs which support the activity, but make no mistake, the money we have inputs into the whole IP version 6 outreach over the last years, about 90 million euros in projects like SixNet, for instance. So if someone would like to see an extensive analysis on how to deploy IP version 6 in a network, our project SixNet, sixnet.org, is an example. You have a tutorial of deep knowledge, which is freely downloadable on the internet, and some experts here. So we spent 90 million in the past. Now is the time to move beyond going projects. It's the time for real deployment, that we get all member states' websites, government websites and services on IP version 6.
Would there be any interoperability issues around this?
No.
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 Thank you,
Oh, thank you.
So I'm going to go to my presentation. Right. So I don't think this microphone is on, is it? No. Oh, it is okay. So this is just going to be a short view, because I'm going to leave you Janne, who's the main data. I've been collecting some data on real V6 usage in Sweden, though, and this is actually a presentation made for the upcoming RIPE meeting next week, but I thought I'll give you a peek preview of the data we have so far. Basically, the traffic is split between native traffic, traffic that's run over 64, and traffic that's run over Teredo. And the first observation to make is that this is from the .se web pages that they provide, that they scrape from the .se domain. And these are a number of HTTP servers that has a quad A record, an IPv6 DNS record. And I think the definition of a web server is that it starts with HTTP, with www. It's not very much. I mean, the oddity in the graphs aside, you can also say that these are fairly stable over time, and they are fairly low in absolute terms, absolute numbers. The same here is this is the graph of quad A records in the zone. Part of this is probably maybe because the operators haven't launched this in any wide scale. There are quite a few providers who have V6. You can get IPv6 from a lot of the operators. Maybe not by calling the sales team, but if you manage to get hold of the engineering team, they'll be happy to give you tunnels, mostly without any SLAs at all. A large part of this is that there's a lot of missing standardization around the DSL. I don't know if Janne is going to talk about this, but there's basically no real clear standardization around what you're going to do when it comes to how to provide this in DSL networks. But that is being worked on, and there is hope that we'll have something by the end of the year. There are some providers working on this. Five of the municipality fiber networks, the Stadsnet, have V6 networks in trial. Five more municipalities are actually looking to do this for their own networks and their own services, which I think is a good thing. I heard this yesterday. But there's also some who have been sitting on these V6 blocks for years and haven't done anything with them. But it's a bit the same as with the operators. There's no clear standardization for how to do this to end users. At NetNode, we have 24 allocated V6 addresses and 15 are in use. There's at least 15 providers who are changing V6 traffic with each other out of the 52 connected. And we are not allowed to actually capture data across the switches. We don't know how much real bandwidth is being used, but we do know how many addresses we have allocated. One Swedish operator who runs their own Toredo service gave me this, their own gateways, gave me this data yesterday. They see around 100 megabit per second for 64 traffic and around 200 megabit per second of peak Toredo traffic. And this is basically 2 per thousand, 2 per mil of traffic in their network is V6, which is not a lot though. There's this joke from one of the providers that they have more ISIS, more OSI traffic for their ISIS than they have V6, which I think is, anyway. 57 allocations down to Sweden, including the supranational registries, split in different categories. This is the tragic news, is that we haven't even doubled in the last, I think it was 4 years. So people are not really applying for a lot more V6 addresses. But the interesting part, and this is the new part, is that all of this doesn't really matter unless there's actually content available reachable over V6. I've been actually trying to get data from a few sources and get access to people who have V6 transport and get this data from them. So many of the Swedish newspapers, I went to these large Swedish newspapers and asked them if they had any plans for V6, and they basically all said, but V4 works for us. And there's one exception, which is Helsingborgs Dagblad, who actually have V6 enabled their website. You can actually go and surf the net from V6. And they actually shared their data with me. So this is the usage statistics from January the 1st, 2008 until September 21st, 2008. It's only V6 access, so I don't know how many percentage of their total traffic is coming in over V6. I only know the V6 traffic. They had 11,504 unique addresses who actually went and looked at their sites, which I actually think is a lot more than I thought it would be, to be honest. And is more interesting is that it's spread across 55/32s. So if you notice, like, 1/32 is roughly one provider. The interesting thing here is that native turned out to be higher ranked, a higher percentage than Toredo was. And as you know, Toredo ships with Windows Vista, and I thought that was going to be actually the highest, but we'll come back to why that's not the case. But I was a bit surprised to see this ranking, that there's so many of these accesses were made over native V6 transport. And native is defined as that the source address was not from an either 64 or Toredo assigned prefix. I don't know, this picture gives me a bit of I don't know if Jukka Jordanberg is here actually, but the fact that OSX came out on top tells me that this is probably themselves looking at the web pages. I don't know, because media industry tends to be OSX heavy, and this does not map into the normal distribution of operating systems. So I don't know, it's a bit hard to interpret. Another thing really puzzled me in the other field here, a significant client base was Solaris, which puzzled me even more, to be honest, but anyway. I went through this. We went around to this. Swedish National Radio allegedly have plans to deploy V6 for their services in 2009, which I think is really good news there. The others, as I said, had no idea at all what I was asking for. The other interesting is we went to another content provider. This is a bit more done in a bit different way than looking at the website. So before you jump out in here of joy, the Pirate Bay is not V6 enabled. Michael Abrahamson did this test where he got them to inject 3 links to a 1 pixel size image. One of them only resolved using IPv4, one resolved using both A and Quad A, and one resolved using only V6. And we tried to see how many, Michael did the data on how many came in, managed to access which of the pixels. And this is from roughly 1 week of data. So 0.5% of the users got the used IPv6 over IPv4 to get the both category. And 6% of all the access got the V6 only GIF, which is maybe a bit high. So we got a bit curious as to why so few people preferred V6 over V4, and I'll get back to that, coming back to this Toredo hack. And if you read the V6 ops mailing list, you'll know why. So 89% were using 64, 9% were using Toredo, and 2% were using other V6 base, which is basically native. Again, Toredo came quite low, which surprised us a bit. Although Vista was again the highest client operating system, and this probably more maps into the distribution out in the wild. So the reason why it turns out why Vista or why Toredo doesn't come so high up in any of these rankings is that in Windows Vista, if you get a domain name that maps to both A and Quad A, and the only V6 address that the Windows Vista stack has, it won't use V6. So although you have that nice V6 address and you could use it, Vista won't use it if that's the only address you have. However, if the idea was for Microsoft to redo the test, I don't know if Michael will do that, but to actually put a numerical V6 address in instead of the canonical host name, and that then it should start preferring, then it will use V6 transport and the data should look different, but we don't know that. And I pulled the same data out of the NetNode website, which has been there for quite a longer time, from 2006 to 2008. It turns out NetNode doesn't seem to be such a popular domain name, though. We didn't have that many address accesses, and I had to remove our own access. Apparently, NetNode staff doesn't do anything but surf our own web page. And we again got the same distribution. Here, the funny thing is that native came out on top. The only explanation I got yesterday, one proposed, was that the only people who can access, who goes to NetNode to read their V6 are the providers, and of course, they have native V6 access. That might be true. I don't know. But as some people have done. That was the last slide I had on these statistics. Just some numbers to show you that there are actually some V6 traffic out there. You might think this is low. It is, but it's a lot more than I thought, to be honest, especially the Helsingborg's Dagblad, who is not associated with the industry in any way. All right. Any questions on that? That was really fast. No, okay. All right. Thank you. With that, we'll leave you with the rest of the session for okay. Janne for the V6 presentation. Here's a nice photo of you, but I don't think that's what you're looking for.
Right. First of all, how many native English speakers are there in the audience here that actually want to hear this? Damn.
What is native?
Well, do you understand Swedish?
No.
You don't? All right. But you run IPv6. Get out. All right, we'll do this in English then. No, that's not the one. I'll try to do this one. So, who understood anything about what Kurt was talking about? Because then you can also go, because you know this. Come on. There we are. From the top. Ah, there we are. Right. I've been given the interesting aspect of trying to explain IPv6 from A to whatever that you want in 50 minutes or so before your lunch. So this will be from 40,000 feet at least, probably more, but I'll try to move fairly quickly in the basics and rather go down to some of the aspects of think of this, think of that. You could do this on a corporate network, etc. But there'll be some basic stuff in there as well for those who haven't actually done this. Well, how many has configured IPv6 in here somewhere? Oh, frighteningly many. That's bad. I hate when people know what I'm talking about. So this will I'll try to go through. I'll try not to fall down. Very quickly over addressing, something about routing, what happens with QoS, etc. I hope to be able to stay a little bit longer on infrastructure deployment, more of the view of how you can look at stuff when you're trying to do this, actually. And a little summary on this. 175 slides is in this deck. I will not show you a lot of those because they're all hidden. But they're there. So they're for your reference. And you can read much more regarding all this stuff when you have the time or the interest or have trouble falling asleep. Right. So, first of all, I very much like to recommend all of this. There are lots on the network just to download for free, but the book on the top is very, very good. So whenever you're going to try to deploy this in your corporate network or wherever, do read this book. It has all the pointers in it, and, well, it's all there, really. The reason why we have IPv6 at all, I think, has been covered in fairly detailed so far. So, I mean, really, one thing that I work in myself is DOCSIS 3. That's actually one of the main things. DOCSIS is the protocol that runs on cable TV networks. So that is one of the main reasons for IPv6, really, because Comcast, being the biggest cable operator in the world, they have something like 27,000 users, not users, sorry, households, and how many address, 27 million users on their corporate net, on their network, and that doesn't really help when you're trying to use the RFC 1918 addresses, because that's 16 million. So actually they run out of addresses. They have to divide the network in two. So they're a very, very strong driver in driving the IPv6 standards forward, especially over cable networks. And also sensor networks. And I think that Vint Cerf perhaps mentioned that. I managed to miss that due to traffic. But the sensor networks will definitely bring V6 forth as well, since there will be so many addresses in every home or behind every NAT device or whatever you want to call it. So the only way to do this will be through V6, probably. And, of course, all the operating systems out there today do support V6. I was a bit surprised also by some of the numbers that Curtis showed up there that showed that OS X was one of the top dogs, because OS X, which I actually run myself, is seriously flawed in many ways. There is no working DHCP stack in it, which is kind of strange. But Microsoft, on the other hand, are absolutely brilliant. They do exactly what they're doing. So, and Vista 2008, et cetera, server, they have all the native support for V6, and they do prefer V6 as well. And they're also very pro-V6, given that they're making all the applications they have V6-aware, and some of them, I'm told, even are V6-only, which we'll see if that works in the end. But anyway, Microsoft is definitely a leading star in the field, as from my point of view. So, how many addresses are there, really? I mean, I think when I began looking at V6, it was kind of hard to get your head around how many addresses really is up to the power of 128. Well, that's a lot. If you divide that by each person, you'll see how many addresses you'll have. I mean, that could just be more interesting. You have something like 52,000 trillion, and trillions, by the way, is 10 to the power of 12. So that's a lot for each person, wouldn't you say? And how many brain cells do you have? Well, your count may vary, as it says, but given that, you still have like 5 to 10 of 17 addresses per brain cell per person on this planet, which probably will suffice. We could go even further in this and calculate how many IPv6 addresses we'll have for each sentient brain cells in the galaxy and so on. And there'll still be lots of them, probably, for each brain cell, so. Well, this is the basics, really. The headers have been simplified a lot, as you can see here. A lot of this crap over here to the left side, which now is red, is taken away into V6. And the main difference is, of course, the address has quadrupled in length. But also, some other interesting stuff has happened. For example, now we call it hop limit instead of time to live, which is more reasonable because that's what we use, TTL4. And we still have the traffic class in it, and we have the new notorious flow label, which I will get back to very slightly. But the main difference, really, is the source address and the destination address are very, very much longer. Given here, we have 2 to the power of 32, and here we are 2 to the power of 128. And what does the address look like then? Well, it's all hexadecimal, thank you very much. Everybody here who loves hexadecimal, raise your hand. Go away. I don't. I like things I can read, numbers. Nonetheless, this is the notation, and get used to it. Hexadecimal numbers, a lot of them, but there are some smart things in it. For example, if you have a number of zeros in following each other, you can abbreviate it by putting a double colon there, but just one. If you put two in there, something will break. The notation for prefixes are almost exactly the same as in CIDR, because if you write in IPv4 something slash 16, for example, you do the exact same thing in V6. You have a slash. But the really beauty thing about V6 is you don't really have to think about this as much as you did in V4, because you're right, you can use variable subnet mask if you really want to have the pain. but you really don't have to. That's one of the main reasons for V6, really, to have so many addresses, you don't have to think about it. You just get used to all these strange little numbers and thingies. Like, you can, as well as in V4, omit leading zeros, but of course you cannot take away them when they're there, so that's absolutely wrong. This is what an address looked like. An aggregable global unicast address. To begin with, the world was very nice, the sun was shining and all that, but so we had an idea with V6 that this would be perfectly aggregable, so everyone would be in a perfect tree of addresses, so the routing tables would be small and all that. This didn't really happen, unfortunately. People started getting provider-independent addresses. They called, you get your own address, so they can ship between different ISPs, etc. So, well, but this was the start of it. And the provider will I'll come to this slightly later, how it's supposed to be standardized, but the beauty of it is that you can, in every V6 address, usually slide it into half. And the front end of it is what you have for network today in V4, and the last part of it is your host. And this is very good, because you don't have this moving around variable subnet mask anymore. You don't have to think about that, really. Because in the end, you have your interface ID, and here you have your networks. And the beauty of it is, usually, you get a /48. Everybody gets a /48. I get a /48. NASA get a /48. Well, I'm not sure they have one, but potentially they can, because what everybody gets is 16 bits that you can fiddle around with to make subnets with if you want to. And 16 bits, that compiles down to compare with an old Class A address. It's like everybody in the world has a Class A address to fiddle around with to build your own networks. And that would be handy, wouldn't it? We're not that many that do have Class A these days, but they're still out there, though. Well, one thing that is slightly different also and takes time to get your head around is that within V6, you get lots of addresses. The first time you look at an IPv6 interface, you don't have just one address. You have trillions of, well, not really, but you do have lots of them. You have, hopefully, you start with a linked local, which is something that's been there for communication with nearby machines. The concept of ARP isn't really there. Instead, we use another concept to assign addresses, to communicate between routers and end hosts, etc. So every host that starts up on a network will start with a linked local address, which is slightly like a MAC address, but you'll see that you can use it in here if you want to, the MAC address, that is. So this little address you'll learn to recognize and love, because every interface you ever start up will have it. And this is used just to talk with the nearest router or do some clever stuff in there. But just bear in mind, you'll have several IPv6 addresses on each physical interface. The link local, you probably have a global address of some sort that you can provide for you some way or another. I'll get to that. And you'll have some other multicast addresses, etc. Of course, given that we have so many addresses, we still want private addresses, don't we? The RFC 1918, the 10, the 192, 168, etc., we're used to use that. And, I mean, there are some aspects, really, that can be good, because using these private addresses hide completely the structure that we're using, because these addresses will never, ever get out to the Internet. To begin with, the fathers of IPv6 thought that, no, they will never use private addressing. Everybody will be reachable from point A to point B at every instance. But, well, everybody don't want that. We had a slight variation of this, of the private space. It looked slightly different. But today, as far as I know, if you see an address, FC00, like that, that's a private address that you'll recognize. You will never route this over the Internet. You will never get traffic from anyone on that address, etc., just like you have today with an address starting with 10 or 192.68, etc., might come in handy at times. Right. How has this been provided then, or allocated, rather say? This is the whole spectrum this is the first bytes of an IPv6 address down to the last one. To begin with, IANA has carved out 3 bits of that that they're using. They're then and they are then giving out /23s to registries, to readers, to the local, to Aaron, etc. After that, they will usually, well, this is the standard model. The world is not as pretty as the standard model, but this was the thought to begin with anyway. So each provider would get /32, and each customer would get /48. I mean, this looks like lots of numbers, but when you look at them after a time, you realize that, well, if I'm an end user, I have /48, and that doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter if I as one person or I as Volvo or whatever, I'll have /48. That's rather convenient, don't you think? Everybody has the same, and everybody will have plenty of space within that address because in that you'll still have, like I said before, the size of subnets, then a number of subnets equal as if you had been given a Class A address. So you'll have lots of subnets to fiddle around with if you want to. You can use logic if you want with the numbers down there. You can actually you can write stuff like cafe or, lots of things in there if you want. Well then, now we've established the IPv6 address is 128 bytes. You split it in half. The uppermost half of it is your network, and the lower half is your individual host on a network. How can we actually get the numbers down here? Of course, we can do it manually. We can just put your IP address like 1, your like 2, your like 3, your like 13, etc. if you want to. But usually you use something called auto-configure, which is an address that the closest router will just provide you with. If you have a router configured with IPv6, you plug something in that it can actually hear it, it will get an IPv6 address on the subnet that you have configured on the router, which is good if you don't use DNS, because you'll not get DNS through that. Bummer. So the host that gets an auto-config address, you still have to configure DNS on that host to get it actually to work on the network, not given you don't actually like typing in these addresses, which I don't. You can also have DHCP, which we all love, which probably makes more sense in many aspects because then you will have DNS in it, and you'll be able to just write down the usual www, whatever site you're interested in. Talking about security, which was mentioned a bit before here, one interesting thing here is if you use the autoconfig, that usually derives the MAC address of your internet card, Ethernet card. And that might be interesting from a security standpoint. It's very convenient because you'll know, all right, I have this subnet and I have this MAC address. That's my IPv6 address. Very good. But what happens when you take your machine, move away to another subnet somewhere like that? You'll still have the same MAC address. So you'll have full global traceability if you're using the 48-bit MAC address over that. So whoever wants to know where you are can use that at all times. And this has been seriously addressed by using pseudo-random numbers instead. So you'll have a random number because lots of people don't really like to have their lives traced so they know exactly where they are at all times. DNS, what does it look like? IPv4, the standard A record, we have a name which corresponds to a number. Look and behold, in V6, we have a name, and that corresponds to a number. But the only difference is that we have an A record, an address record in IPv4, and we have quad A, it's called, in V6. The backwards is a bit messy. It looks like this backwards. If you know the number, you'll get the name. And it does look the same, only slightly longer, I'd say, in V6, but it works exactly the same. So that's addressing. Routing. Routing is exactly the same as you've always done. You just need to know what the differences are between V4 and V6. I mean, these are the standard IGPs that we can use. For example, RIP which actually works these days with RIP2 for V4, has its equivalent calling RIPNG for V6. Exactly the same, but they don't actually talk to each other. They are, in many aspects, as two completely separate protocols. They're like ships in the night. They don't know of each other. They don't talk to each other. They don't interchange routes or anything. So it's just another routing protocol that works on the same principle as RIP does. The same goes for OSPF. They have two completely distinct protocols. They're done on this basic, on the same basis. They're link state protocols, but they don't talk to each other. V6 does V6, V4 does V4. They don't communicate to each other. ISIS, however, is a multi-protocol that does extend. So there you have incorporated V6 into it, much like BGP. And don't use enhanced IGRP. I shouldn't say this because I work in Cisco, but come on, that's not a standard. I can't stand standard. Things that are proprietary, so don't use it. Quality of service, then. This is one of the fun things, or the potential for fun and good things with IPv6, because in V4, we have the concept of type of service, a class of service that we can use. We have a few bytes in one little part of the header that we can use to categorize stuff and steer it into different queues so we can take care of, for example, for video streams, etc. But we do still have that in V6, but we also have what we call the flow label. And this is a rather long label that can actually attach an identification to each flow. So you can separate not just classes of traffic, like video. You can actually have my video stream is better than your video stream because I have a cooler flow level than you have. So this gives the potential to do a lot more with quality of service. If that will be implemented is another question we'll see. So keep your eyes open, as they say. Right. That was the definite high flyer on V6, addressing, routing, etc. So let's go into how can we actually survive the transition from V4 to V6, which is probably more interesting to most of you. You probably know this, some of you. Well, there are three distinct ways of doing stuff. You can do dual stack, which is something we did. I'm old enough to remember the day when IPX didn't stand for what it stands for today. And when we had like OSI and other DECnet and interesting things, when we ran dual stack on the routers and on the hosts. And the same thing goes with IPv6 and IPv4, of course. We can have an IPv4 on the machine, as we usually do, and we can also plug in IPv6. Tunneling. This will happen a lot. It already happens a lot. All of you that has Vista has tunnels in it. And they have like ISATAP and Teredo, and we get down slightly to those. But also, these are the two basic things that can give you communication. We do have to, probably do have to have some sort of translation mechanisms as well. I mean, this is not exactly NAT, but almost, because we'll see what we can do with this. But it will basically give you, if you have an IPv6 server over there, and I have IPv4, a translation mechanism will allow me, using only IPv4, still to reach the IPv6 server over there. And all these will be used in combination in horrendous ways. Be certain of that. But please steer yourself to some way that will make your company work. Tunnels, then. Here also we have a plethora of things that we can use. The easiest way, or to start with, are the manuals, the GREs, just having one tunnel connecting from one point to another and transporting the IPv6 in it. Yes, that works. Not very flexible, though. So the more flexible things are down here. And also here we have lots of things to choose from, unfortunately. Compatibly, IPv4 has been deprecated, which means that you shouldn't use it. It's still there, but you shouldn't use it. 64 is used a lot. 6/4 shouldn't use, but it's there. So just you have to get used to all these different names and try to understand the different differences between them in time. ISATAP and Teredo are two tunnel mechanisms that are spreading like wildfire. They are in Vista. They are implementations on Linux, on OS X, thank God, for all of these as well. More or less good working, unfortunately, but they are there. It might be advisable, if you're sitting on a network that you're thinking about having IPv6 enabled, you have to learn a little bit about these things, because these things will be there whether you want it or not. You have to learn to recognize them. They move on very distinct European numbers, TCP numbers, etc. So read the documentation on how to recognize when people are doing this, because your network will break when you start trying to implement the IPv6, that's for sure. Right, to have things not break, you would like to have some sort of high availability mechanisms, of course. HSRP or GLVP or VRRP are things that are in V6 as well, but with variable success. They usually work if you're lucky, but be careful with them. One thing that always is in IPv6 is the NUD, the neighbor unreachability detection. And each router on a given segment will send out NUDs on the network. And each host will read these and thereby determine, does that router work? Yeah. Does that router work? Yeah. Does that? No. I'll use that. But what you can do to have this actually work like a high availability, well, high availability, but still you have some sort of router redundancy, trim it down. It's 30 seconds by default, but you can trim it down a lot to like a couple of seconds. And then you have actually a very simple, completely standardized reachability function on your network. So, yeah, that works really good. Multicast. We have multicast on V6. What don't we have on V6? What I'm doing, broadcast. We don't have exactly broadcast on V6. But we do have something which confuses a lot of people, calling MLD. If you know what IGMP is, I'm sitting here, I want to watch a video stream, I send an IP, IGMP to the nearest switch router, which will open up the gates for me and I'll receive my stream. Hopefully, my neighbors will not see the same stream, and that's what IGMP snooping is for. So, MLD has been created, and here the confusion starts, because IGMP V2 corresponds to MLD version 1. Why use the same version numbers? It will be much funnier if people make mistakes. And the interesting part here on a network is that MLD snooping isn't exactly a given on all switches out there, which will lead to, if you send up an MLD request for a specific multicast, sure, the router will send down the multicast to you and everybody else if this guy doesn't support MLD snooping. So that's one thing to look out for, because you'll easily saturate your complete network with multicast if you don't have that function here. One thing also to keep in mind is scalability. I mean, the thought to begin with was, well, IPv6, we have a very small routing table. That'd be good for the routers. Yeah, didn't really happen, unfortunately, since we're now shifting out provider-independent IPv6 addresses a bit all over the place. So the routing table will eventually be as large or probably much larger than the IPv4 routing table. We'll see. But also, as I mentioned before, you have lots of addresses in each interface. And this will put strain on the TCAMs and the other memory components of switches and routers. They'll have to keep track of every IP address out there. Because for each physical machine, in IPv4, you have an IPv4 address and you have a MAC address. Good, that's one entry. But in IPv6, you'll have at least three or four or more, given depending on how many multicast, etc. things you have. And also, in IPv6, we have this really neat mechanism that can actually, you can keep an old IPv6 address and have new ones every now and then if you want to. And the old one will work. That is something you have to keep in mind, because there's a timer attached to that. So if you use your DHCP server, for example, to give IPv6 all over and you realize, oh, bugger, that was a really bad network plan I did. I have to do this again. I'll do a new one, and you deliver new IPv6 addresses to everyone. That's cool, because you'll have the old IPv6 address still there. And you do it again and again and again. You have all the addresses on each and every one. And that sort of puts strain to the routers. But so do keep, that's a brilliant mechanism to, for moving people around, to be able to have two IPv6 addresses at the same time. But it can also be a strain. So know what you're doing. Take down the timers, very, very short. If you want to make a change, and be aware of the fact that they will stay around for a long, long time unless you take down the timers on that. So this was something I saw in another presentation. I stole it. I think it's rather, well, it shows you actually the phases that you have to go through it. I mean, most of you out there, or most in the world, are in this phase right now. Oh, I don't need IPv6. Well, some of you, actually, you're probably around here, rather. Then, well, it seems to be that this is the usual way that people perceive IPv6. I don't need that. Oh, why should I need that? Well, all right, then how can we make this work? And then you get depressed because things don't work and they're still broken, but eventually we'll get there. Right. Going to data part of the... by the way, on each and every head slide here, you also have links to where you can find stuff for all the different parts. And as I said, there are 175 slides in there, so a lot of more detail on each and every subject in this is in there. And feel free to just ping me a mail or whatever. So, coexistence. This is now getting more interesting, I think. To start with, of course, we can use dual stack with all the advantages and disadvantages that gives, and this is just a slight picture of that. We can use our tunnels. We can use whatever tunnel mechanism we want. And we can also use our automatic tunnels. These are our static tunnels. So let's look into how would a campus look like. There are three variants, as we see it, on how you can build a campus network. You can go dual stack, which is probably the most clean-cut way of doing things, the real thing, how you should do it, etc. But it's not always doable, is it? Because not all equipment supports V6 directly. And all layer 3 thingies has to do this in hardware, which is also not given. So you have many interesting performance issues if you go dual stack probably today with the equipment that you have there. I mean, really, Ethernet switches, they don't just fall over and die in 3 years. Well, some of them do, but usually they don't. They should live on for like 20 years, and it's not given that all the Ethernet switches that are 10 or 20 years old support IPv6. I'm fairly sure that they don't really. The other mechanism that we can use, or rather description design that we use, is called hybrid. We do use dual stack in that where we can, but we use tunnels for the rest just to get things going, really. And there are advantages of this, because then you can use all the equipment that doesn't support IPv6, and you'll have the disadvantage of having lots of tunnels in it, because tunnels are inherently bad, really. I mean, you don't know exactly what goes in the tunnels. You'll have, well, we'll get to that. There are some interesting aspects on why you really should try to avoid tunnels. One special case also is a service block, which might be a good starting point, really. Just to get started. We'll see how it runs out. So let's look at a typical network. We have some hosts, we have a campus with some switches, we have a core, and we have a data center of some sort. And what happens here? Well, this is dual stack. Everything is fine. This is what you probably would aim for. Sooner or later, you can, whenever IPv4 is dying, whenever that's going to happen, you can take it away and things will just work. But do beware, for example, of the MLD snooping in this, because it's not a given that all the layer 2 switches support MLD snooping. And if you run multicast in this, this will make a lot of noise out there for your host. So be careful. Management can also be an interesting part in this. Usually, most equipment can actually give IPv6 information over V4, but this is something that you have to be aware of and track down really good and how you want to do it. Will your platform like OpenView or whatever, will that support IPv6 all the way? Will it talk IPv6? Will it understand IPv6? And this is, well, not exactly a perfect world either still. And also some things like intelligent IP services. With that, we're talking about compression of things. Like, there are so many protocols out there that are not really smart. So if you go with WAN, you can usually compress like the Microsoft protocols or Oracle protocols, etc., if you go over WAN. And that is also something that is very, very much used within corporations. So have an eye on that, that it actually will work for you if you go dual stack completely. But, and also, of course, if you run dual stack, you'll put a strain on every machine that you have. So if you have a machine that are running lots of CPU or have scarce amounts of memory, that one has to be replaced. Be sure about that. So have a look on that. The hybrid version then. The hybrid is a variation that you use since it's complicated to get dual stacked on all the hosts out there. But if you have like Vista, for example, out there, you will have ISATAP installed to begin with. Oh, thank you very much. It's alive, it's alive. Right. Where were we? So, the hybrid model. Here you begin with the core and the data center, because that's probably where you have the easiest, the fewest number of things to actually configure. I mean, there are lots more of these guys out here, and especially of these. So this is one way to start with. But you have to beware of one thing when you're using like ISATAP, because ISATAP creates a flat network. So everybody on an ISATAP network, on an ISATAP tunnel, if you have one termination point, or two, well, two in this case, but here, everybody that terminates in this router will see on layer two all the other hosts, which could be interesting. It's not uncommon that you do have some sort of this is economy and this is engineering and this is legal, etc., and you separate them by filters and stuff like that, and so they have access to different servers in your network. And suddenly, everybody has access to everything. Not exactly what you planned, probably. So there are ways around this, of course. You could, for example, have separate instances of the ISATAP termination points for each and every one. But that might be interesting given the way that ISATAP works, because ISATAP works with DNS. So if a host wants to communicate at all, it starts with just querying the DNS server. Is there an ISATAP server? Sure. Boom. There you are, and you're on ISATAP. So you have to be very, very conscious about how to do this so you won't break any security in this. Talking about security, that is, also interesting, of course, because this is a tunnel. How do you listen into that? There are variants of this, of course. I mean, this is the variant that we had on the previous slide. We have dual stack carry. You could probably do this as well, dual stack there and ISATAP there. We'll still call it a hybrid network. Given your circumstances, you'll have to look into what fits you. So, why shouldn't you use ISATAP? Well, as I said, you'll be sort of flying blind because the tunnels will have lots of traffic in them and you have no idea of what's going on there, and especially from a quality of service perspective. Because from this endpoint, you'll pour all the traffic into one ISATAP tunnel unless you configure it really, really granular. But then you're doing quality of service with ISATAP, and that will probably be quite messy. So the first place where you actually see what kind of traffic you're doing through this will be at the endpoint of the tunnel. Here, packets will start falling out where you can actually start classifying in them in the next step here. But down here, you're more or less flying blind, as I said. You'll have broken your quality of service probably if you're using ISATAP. So just be careful with that. Know what you're doing. So the last one. Once again, we have our typical campus with some hosts and switches and stuff and down to the data center. One way to start is what we call a service block. And a service block is rather much like something that you just bolt on to your network just to get started and try things out. And this is almost like the hybrid network because you just attach ISATAP all the way out here instead and just let it go through. But, well, you'll have to think about it. Or you can even have an extra by the size. You have all your V4 traffic over here and all only V6 traffic over here. This will give you some sort of control, still given the disadvantages, of course, of quality of service, etc. But if you do this, you'll have a little bit more control of it. And it's a variant of the hybrid, but just a way of discussing how to build stuff, really. Lots of text describing that. So, that about campus networks. Data center, going further into the network. When we get down here, IPv6 is not really a given in all aspects. Things are coming out now these days. I mean, there are, like for SANs, there are nowadays IPv6, etc. But there's one thing that you probably should be aware of, and that is NIC teaming. In all data centers, you usually have more than one NIC for each server because, you want redundancy, and then perhaps you need more than 1 gigabit into a server, and you don't have, like, multiple 10 gigabits. So you'll probably use NIC teaming. And there are some very interesting implementations from NIC vendors these days. So beware, if you're going to go into the data center, please be very careful on this side. Start out with one internet interface on the server that you're used, then apply another and see if it actually breaks. Some of them work, some of them don't. And also, there will be things that will not forever work on IPv6, probably. And there you have to resort to the ugly NAT, of course. I mean, you can always have different views on is NAT good, is NAT bad, but here you will probably use it. So when you have transformed all your network into IPv6, you will have a NAT PT somewhere. Or the other way around. This is also, of course, one way of starting out with IPv6. You could do it the other way around. You have an IPv6 server here, and you have an IPv4 only here. But, I mean, that's just stupid, isn't it? Just for demos, testing, etc., sure, but not for production network. Because the NAT devices here are not really up to speed. I think some of the other presenters said that also, that it's hard to do this. In hardware even, it's really hard to have the scalability, all the ports, all the addresses, all the transformation being done there. It's not easy. We'll see what the industry does. This might be the solution for the future. I don't know yet. I mean, IPv6 has been around for some time now, that's for sure. And it hasn't really taken off. But as I don't know, it was Patrick, I think, who had the flying pig there. Given sufficient thrust, pigs fly just fine, as they say. So, moving away from the corporate network, the campus, out into the wide area. And here things are actually a little bit easier, because this is where we started. All the routers that are out there that use other interfaces, I mean, the small routers that you have for branches, et cetera, they have all the support in the world that is out there for IPv6. They have support for all the technologies, like frame relay or leased lines or Ethernet or whatever you want, or MPLS. This will probably work. This will probably be the easiest part for you to do. This is where you'll do dual stack. Otherwise, no. Just do dual stack out there. That's probably the easiest way. But be aware, not everything works on IPv6 still, unfortunately. That is the case. This is still work in progress. So be careful. Most of it will. Remote access. Yeah, this actually works as well. We can use both the IPsec-based VPNs or the SSL-based VPNs, and that works just fine. So there's no reason to say, no, I can't do IPv6 because we have remote users, because you can. It will work just fine. There are clients out there. Sorry about the commercials there. Didn't mean to have that. They do work like this today, and you'll have your client out there, which will actually connect through IPv4, through the standard internet, and then it will tunnel IPv6 straight through it and have a termination endpoint inside of that. And this works just fine, really. So there's really no reason to stand back on that. So just go away and install it. Fire away. So the crash course on IPv6, a tutorial in 50 minutes, which is a challenge, I'd say. But this is what you'll have to do now. I've given you a few pointers that I know are pain points. Look out for that. Don't do that. Because you don't have to fall into that. But then use something like this. There are some variants, actually, of this in this presentation. Things you have to go through. Now, go back home. Think of this. Where will you start? Look through your network. Get some IPv6 addresses box. Just one will be okay. A /48 will probably be good enough for everyone. And, of course, start doing the funny stuff, like budgets, because this will cost money. And someone will have to approve it. Let's take this away from, I'll fiddle around with this in my spare time, to up there on the board meeting. This is something you have to do. You have to understand. You'll get there. And, I mean, if you look at it, imagine yourself like a coordinate system right now. We have a y-axis, and we have an x-axis. The y-axis, that's pain. And the x-axis, that's time. Right now, we have IPv6 up here. It's painful, right? Doesn't really work. We don't get very much. And IPv4 is down here. Cool. What happens over time? They'll go like this. And you'll just have to decide for yourself, when will the pain be lower in IPv6 than in IPv4? That is up to you to decide. So, go forth on that. Have a look at all these. Get your DNS server to work as soon as possible. That's the first thing, probably the first server that you want to work in your network for V6. You have to think about how to have your management. You have to look at your routing protocol. Don't you IDRP. You have to look at all the other transport services, and you have to find an ISP that actually provide you with V6 services, which isn't exactly a given today. But if you people start asking the ISPs that, what their ISP, how much do you charge for your V6 service? That will be good. Just by doing that, you'll create a stir. So do go out there and push your ISPs to that. Compliance. How will I know that my stuff actually works with V6? Well, there are some IPv6 ready thingies out there, small stickers or badges or whatever that you get. And we do have some of them. I've got them certified for some of the products. And do go out there and check all your vendors and all our competitors and friends out there so you know that it actually will work. So, I'll be boring. I won't be techie. Business value. Why should you do this? This is the starting point at all times. I mean, come on. Someone has to pay for this. So start with the business value. Why should you do this? And when is the pain big enough? That's the things you have to think of first. The technical stuff, you'll get there. And also, one interesting thing. I mean, you have seen the slides of the IPv4 pool going down the drain and all that. One thing, actually, it was quite funny. I did a similar presentation like a month ago, and I said, there'll be panic in the press. IPv4 is over. It's all ended. And that happened just like 2 weeks ago. It was one of the newspapers in Sweden that had some black on that. But this will happen a lot more. And what I do think will happen as well very much is when people start realizing, well, wait a minute, V4 addresses are running out. I better get one now, please. There'll be panic. I mean, what happens when, well, there's no food in this. Oh, I'll go get some food just for safekeeping. And everybody will do this. I mean, the V4 addresses will, I don't think it will be nice like that. Like that, probably. I'm a pessimist in this aspect. I think it will be like less than a year. Then, unless Ryan and all the other guys say, no, you won't get anyone. All this stock combing back and all. Well, you know all that stuff. But the panic in the press will happen. And by then, it's good to be on the V6 train already because you will not get the V4 address. Either from that there is no V4 addresses out there, or because they've changed policies, you cannot have any more V4 addresses. So, learn. That's what you're doing. Good. Keep doing that. Read more. Read what's behind all these slides as well. Read all the links. Buy the books. Read till your eyes bleed, damn it. And, well, IPv4 and IPv6 are not fully equal base today. not the reality, but the potential for V6 is better. I mean, we have the flow label, which is cool, which will be good for all the quality of service. We have IPsec, almost, in the protocol. At least you'll know that everybody that talks to V6 will be able to encrypt and decrypt traffic. I mean, there are things out there that are really, really good with V6, for sure. Things are moving around, so keep an eye out for that, but you'll see. So, last words, right? Well, you can read for yourself. And if there are questions out there, I'm happy to take them. I'm between you and your lunch. I won't keep you any longer. Thank you.
Questions? Any questions from the audience? You all focus on lunch. No questions?
Huh.
All right. Thank you very much, all. Enjoy lunch. And thanks to the presenters for coming here. And we have a small gift for you as well.